Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing now with 92-year-old Walt Burr of Merced, California, a Navy fighter pilot credited with 2 confirmed kills while flying off the carrier USS Essex with VBF 83, bombing and strafing Japanese positions in the Pacific for the last 6 months of World War II. The air groups aboard the Essex would receive the Presidential Unit Citation for their work throughout the war, and Walt was recognized with the Distinguished Flying Cross. The President of the United States of America takes pleasure in presenting the Distinguished Flying Cross to Ensign Walter E. Burr, United States Naval Reserve, for heroism and extraordinary achievement while participating in aerial flights and operations against the enemy in the vicinity of Nansei, Shoto, and Kyushu, Japan, as pilot of a carrier-based plane during the period of 18 March 1945 to 24 May 1945. He participated in 20 strikes against enemy shipping, airfields, and installations, inflicting extensive damage. His skill and courage were at all times inspiring and in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. So they gave you that DFC with those flowery words. Did that mean something to you?
Well, yeah, you appreciated it, but you just were doing your job. You're doing what you enlisted to do, and at least they recognized that you were doing what you were supposed to be doing.
Well, I think this goes a little beyond that. Heroism, extraordinary achievement, his skill and courage were at all times inspiring and in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. Sounds like they're saying if you didn't do your job as well as you did it, that things could have turned out differently.
Oh, yes.
What were some of the missions where it became clearest to you that if things hadn't gone exactly the way they went, you wouldn't be sitting here talking to me right now?
Well, I think of one in particular that was unusual. We took off in clear weather, but there was a front between the fleet and Okinawa. And our mission was to go to Okinawa, bomb it, and do some damage. The leader of our Corsair group led us into the front in a turn. Well, I just kept turning and came back out of the front and figured everybody. And when I came back out to where we had gone in, I'm all by myself. So I turned around, went back in the front, and started climbing. Can fly in the clouds, that's no problem. But I'm heading towards Okinawa. I didn't know what else to do, and I didn't know where anybody was. I finally came out on top of the front, and I was up at about 35,000 feet. Beautiful blue sky, nobody around. You maintain radio silence. I don't call up and say, where is everybody? I just assume they're, well, I don't know where they are. But anyway, I look around and down behind me, there's a flight of Corsairs. They got on the radio saying, bogey, 12 o'clock high. And the bogey is me. Well, that was a group from another carrier, and they were all together and going to Okinawa. So we communicated, and they came up and looked me over to see if I was a real, not a Japanese in a Corsair. Anyway, I joined up with them, and we went on to Okinawa. Well, Okinawa was socked in. We did our best to bomb whatever we could bomb, and I flew with them through all this and then back to the fleet. When we got back to the fleet, why, the whole group of ships turned into the wind so you could land. I landed on the back on the Essex. The air group commander, the captain of the ship, called and ordered me up to bridge, because I was the only one from the Essex that got to Okinawa that day. And not that I did anything, only had one hole in the plane. Somebody must have fired from somebody on the ground on Okinawa. But anyway, I got up to the bridge and gave him my report, and that's all there was to it. Well, I could have gone back to the ship where everybody else went back and landed. None of them went to Okinawa from the Essex that day.
all the other Corsairs had come back to the Essex.
Yeah, and I could have gone back, but I didn't know. We were maintaining radio silence. It did what I thought I should do. I would have gotten to Okinawa all by myself and done it and gone back home, you know. But that you didn't really want to be out there flying around by yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Did that put a little lump in your throat when you realized that none of the other guys had ever gone?
Well, not by then, but it did when I first came back out of the clouds and saw that nobody was around. I said, what do I do now? Well,
yeah.
What I thought I should do is what I did.
Well, and a lot of things come to mind on that. I mean, A, you hear them calling out Bogey and you know it's you, and if they had acted too fast, they could have shot you down.
Oh, yeah, but...
And what if you never encountered those guys? Well, what if you had gone by yourself?
Well,
you would have been in a more dangerous position,
oh,
right?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. By that time, I was pretty much on my way to Okinawa.
And you mentioned you only had one hole in your plane.
Yeah.
Of all those missions you flew, how frequent was that you would end up with some holes in that Corsair?
Very seldom.
Did you ever feel them when they happened?
Yeah, you could hear them.
You act like this isn't a big deal. This is your life.
Yeah.
You're a, well, what are you, a 20-year-old kid?
I'm not even that yet. I can't vote. can't buy a drink.
Uh-huh.
But at that age, you think you're going to live forever. Whatever's going to happen, not going to happen to me. It's going to happen to the other guy.
Uh-huh.
And it does happen to the other guy. If you get back home, it didn't happen to you.
That's true. But you also have a lot of examples where you almost were that other guy.
Well, yeah.
And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that you mentioned Okinawa and your group was very prolific during the assault on Okinawa. Wasn't there a situation there where there was a position that you were supposed to hit that was really tricky to hit on the side of a mountain or something like that? Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
Tell me what's that whole story?
Well, when you're supplying ground support to the Marines or the Army, but in this case the Marines, we would go with bombs or rockets and sometimes with napalm, you would go and do your strafing or dropping your bombs, aiming away from our troops, not towards them. Well, there was a situation that they wanted us to drop towards them. They couldn't dislodge the Japanese from these caves and tunnels or whatever they were in, I don't know. And we did. The danger of overshooting and hitting our own guys was great when you do that.
Uh-huh.
So you don't do that if you possibly can avoid it. In this situation, they said, oh, try it. So we did, and we didn't hit them. We went pretty low before we dropped stuff, because we wanted to be darn sure we hit what we were aiming at and didn't overshoot. We didn't overshoot. We did it.
So what you're saying is if you're not accurate, it's going to cost American lives.
Yeah, right.
And so this was like a cave or a position the Japanese had on the side of a hill?
Right.
So you go super low. I mean, it almost sounds like it has to be the perfect shot. You're releasing a bomb that has to kind of slide into this cave?
Yeah, so apparently bombs needed to be able to do damage in the cave instead of the other side of the hill, which is just hill,
right.
Rock, whatever.
So the margin for error is pretty much zero.
Pretty much zero.
Yeah.
And if you go the other way, over your friendlies towards the enemy, that's the normal way of doing it.
Right.
And if you overshoot, it's no big deal.
But you couldn't do that in this situation.
Right.
Because of the topography.
Yeah, I guess. They had the problem, and they took it to us and said, can you do this? And we said, yeah, we could do it.
Even though you'd never done it before?
Right, well,
never trained for that kind of shot?
No. Well, but you knew what we needed to do, and we were able to do it.
Is that one of those where there's some relief afterwards?
Oh, yeah. Great relief to know that, because we really can't be positive that we succeeded. You know, you don't get out of your car and look and see what you did to your bumper. You know, this all happens fast, and you get out of there. And the report was great. I'll tell you kind of a humorous situation.
All right.
We're hitting a naval base on the very northeast tip of Honshu, which is the main Japanese island. And there's a peninsula of land that comes out and forms a bay. And out on the end of, near the end of this peninsula is a Japanese naval base. And we're going to hit that because close to the northern part of Honshu, the northernmost island is Hokkaido. And there were 6 railroad ferries. There was no bridge or tunnel or anything. With the naval base there, it needed to be knocked down, slowed down and stuff because we wanted to go hit these ferries. So we hit the naval base and we lose, I guess, 1 or 2 dive bombers. But one of our Corsair pilots gets shot up and lands in this bay. But he's far enough away from the naval base, they don't realize that he has gone down. Or if they do, they have ignored it. He gets out of this plane, goes on the shore. On the peninsula, there's nothing but scrub trees and brush and stuff. There's no buildings, but there's a railroad line, and this is late in the day, and we are over him. We see that he's all right, but we don't circle or anything because that would tell the Japanese that somebody is alive down there.
Yeah.
But we know he's all right. There isn't time to get the OS-2U seaplane to fly out from a battleship or cruiser to land to pick him up. So we have to go back to the fleet. We do. We're back over him at dawn the next day, and he comes out of the brush, and he waved to us. His name is Vern Kumbi, and he's all right. And we get the OS-2U out there. It lands in the bay, and there's pretty good surf, wind blowing, and the OS-2U is on pontoons, sits up in the air pretty high, so Kumbi in the water, no way could he reach up, and he needs help to get on. So the pilot gets partway out of the cockpit and on the wing and throw him a rope, or whatever happened, the pilot fell into the water and hit the throttle, and the plane taxis out into the bay. Now you got 2 guys there. They got life preservers on. Kumbi had his raft, even his rubber raft, you know.
So the plane got away from them. They're tailing behind the plane. They're just floating in the water.
Right. They get another OS-2U out there.
And the Japanese still haven't seen them.
They apparently didn't realize that they were there. So another plane comes, and that guy rescues both pilots and takes off. And by that time now, the Japanese are shooting at them, but not hitting them, apparently. They got it out. Well, now, what do you do with the plane that's taxiing out on the water? And the head folks tell us they'll sink it. So we started shooting at it. We shot a little bit, and we were hitting the fuselage fine. But that wasn't sinking. It dawned on us we needed to shoot at the pontoons, which we did and sunk it. But the laughable deal is the pilot falling out of his plane. It all turned out fine. No, nobody was hurt. We were just tickled to death that it all turned out.
With the dropping of the bombs in August of 45, hastening the end of the war, you know, a lot of guys have told me they really believe that that spared their life.
Oh, I firmly believe that because, all right, they dropped the bombs at the end of the war, but the plan, we weren't coming home. We were going to be part of the invasion.
And you've already been bombing and strafing Japan.
Oh, yeah.
But now troops are going to come ashore. You're going to be flying more of those missions, and the opposition would have been...
The Japanese were going to put up a very stiff resistance, and if you got shot down, you might survive the plane crash, but the Japanese would have killed you in a minute, you know.
They weren't going to be taking any prisoners anymore.
No.
Not that they treated their prisoners well to begin
with.
Oh,
God, no. No.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for giving us a little taste of what it was like to be a Corsair pilot. I know almost a couple of years ago now, you had a chance to go back to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
You had to fly off an old Air Force base. I don't know if that was, you know, if that stoked the rivalry between the Navy pilots and the Air Force pilots.
Yeah.
To go from Castle here in your backyard to Washington, D.C., see the World War II Memorial and all those other sites with a bunch of other veterans. What was that experience like? What did it mean to you?
It meant a great deal. It meant a lot of people saying thank you by contributing the money that made it possible, plus the dedicated folks that made it all physically possible. They were wonderful. You didn't do what you did expecting wonderful treatment like that, but it was nice when it happened. It was nice to think that the hundreds of people that donated money and the dozens of people who donated their time and probably money to make all that happen 70 years later.
Well, I think it's an acknowledgement that we know we wouldn't be here without what you and all those other guys did. And I'm just interested, too, since the driving force behind the Honor Flight movement is to let guys like you see in person the memorial built in your honor and the honor of those who didn't come home. So when you're there at that World War II memorial and there's that wall of gold stars, what were you thinking about while you were there?
The guys that didn't come home. I had a roommate when we were on Maui in training. He was up on a training flight and had a mid-air collision, was killed. That was pretty personal. I was able to, we came in at the end of the war to Seattle. It so happens that Harold Habeneck was from Seattle. He was my roommate there in Hawaii. I was able to go see his folks and did. And we communicated up until the time they passed away.
That must have meant the world to them
to
hear from you.
And it was something I could do and did.
And I'm sure there's so much more you did that we didn't hear about. Walt Burr, 92 years young. We're out of time here on the radio. I do have a few more of Mr. Burr's stories in the extended podcast version accessible at hometownheroesradio.com, including how he met his wife when he returned to Rutgers after the war. Not surprisingly, Walt says he'd take an F4U Corsair over a Mustang, but next time we're going to hear the other side of that debate from a P-51 pilot turned POW turned football coach. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.